Hello, everybody. I'm Eli Lake, and I am joined today with the Washington editor of The Nation magazine, Chris Hayes. How are you today, Chris?
I'm good, Eli. How are you doing?
Could be better with the demise of my newspaper, but
I want to state for the record that I was a big fan of The Sun as a paper. Not a huge fan of its politics, but we actually at The Nation ran a piece about The Sun that was a pretty
It's funny. The Nation, as I've counted this, Victor Navasky wrote a very nice. He too did not like the politics, and he wrote a very nice piece. And then you had. The other kind of news feature, which was I think critical but appreciative.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Then there was just kind of an awful column from Eric Alterman you read about the paper. But that was water under the bridge. Anyway, so we all mourn. Hey, but if I could say something to the just before we kind of get started to the Blogging Heads viewers and people in general on the internet, we journalists don't have a very good economic model right now. But you really need to start paying for news. I'm quite serious. And just as I think that there are people who will pay a premium for locally grown produce,
right?
Maybe people could start, you know, out of conscience, paying a premium to just buy the paper physically.
Yeah.
You know? Do you know what I mean? Because, I mean, everybody gets everything on the internet, and it's very convenient. It's nice. But maybe, like, to support, you know, newspapering and journalism.
I wonder if, I mean, that's an interesting idea, like shifting to like the conscience guilt model.
People will not buy certain investment products because they invest in CNN
or something like that.
There are all kinds of premiums that, you know, markets are kind of created, and like, why can't the physical newspaper be one of them? Because right now, you're irrelevant. I mean, believe me, The Sun went through this. I mean, The Sun at times tried to charge people for their website or at least get their credit card information. That didn't work. It made us, you know, made you completely irrelevant because you need to be on the internet. But on the other hand, you know, eventually you've got to pay your reporters and photographers and secretaries and everything like that. So there needs to be some model, and I'm just sort of making an appeal to people in the, you know, just news consumers that, you know, you should pay for what we do, even if you disagree with, like, you know, kind of my perspective.
Right.
I'm out there trying to get new facts into the public debate, as Chris is trying to get new facts into the public debate from his perspective. And there's a difference between what I think we do and what a blogger does, you know, from his living room.
Yeah, I mean, I think the premium here. I mean, I think there are bloggers that do reporting. I think it's less.
That's true. No, I don't want to say all bloggers. Yeah. I'm just saying it's not as minimal as having an opinion on the news.
That's right. It's less the product and more the activity, which is reporting, which is introducing new facts, introducing things that had not yet been entered into the record, and that activity, the business model for that activity, and that's an activity that can often be quite expensive.
Right.
The business model that will sustain that activity is tremendously unclear and disturbingly, elusive.
and we see it now, right? And we see it. I mean, we already see it with all the newspapers have closed down so many foreign bureaus.
Yes.
And I think you're going to start seeing, you know, the economic model for even very big newspapers is not viable. And I think that hurts all of us in the quality.
Yeah, I agree.
There's some interesting, you know, kind of new models that are coming up. There are two investigative, ProPublica and the Washington Independent.
Yeah.
Are two models of that kind of, I guess they subsist in some ways on money, like a kind of foundation would, but they subsidize investigative journalism and journalism that's really, you know, without the page. So anyway, there has to be, it's just something to think about. So, you know, just think of when you read a newsroom, you're like, wow, I didn't know that. That was really good. It explained a lot of things to me. Think about buying a copy of that in the newsstand.
I second that.
Same thing, by the way, could be said, right, if you really like a new record or something like that. Instead of getting the, like, downloadable MP3 for free, you know, maybe figure out a way to, like, support the artist or something.
That's
it's
right.
the same, similar kind of concept.
Yes,
anyway.
That's right.
I am stumped. But let's go to the events of the day. You want to start with Sarah Palin versus Joe Biden and then move on to Obama?
Yeah, sure. Let's do that, since that was last night and that's on probably a lot of people's minds right now.
Yeah. Did you see the debate?
I did see the debate. I will admit that when 9:30 rolled around, I was multitasking between the debate and the devastating, soul-crushing defeat by the Chicago Cubs. So my attention was a little divided, particularly because the second inning was such a, it was the baseball equivalent of the Iraq War. Just one, one blunder after another. I did see the debate, and I'm assuming you watched as well.
I did, actually. I saw the debate at the National Review's Washington Bureau. And you can actually see me. I did like a 10-minute thing with Jim Garrity and Mark Hemingway as a post-rap. But it was kind of an interesting place to see it. I thought Sarah Palin, having really been among people on the sort of center-right who were willing to give her a chance and in some ways were something excited, but then the Katie Couric interviews were painful in some ways to watch.
Yeah.
And I thought she did much better. I mean, granted, the expectations were sufficiently very low, but she did much better in this debate. I mean, I didn't really. I think that she did what she needed to do, which is that, at least in terms of, forget for a second McCain-Palin versus Obama-Biden, which I think is going to be a turnout election.
Right.
In terms of her status about whatever happens in the election, will she be a viable candidate in 2012 and considered a leader of the Republican Party and, more importantly, maybe the conservative cause? I think she passed that test.
I agree that she did not. I think people had elevated, they had depressed expectations and I would say elevated expectations for some sort of dramatic, massive meltdown. This woman is a professional politician
And when she talks about what she's comfortable with, she's fine. She's cogent. When she talks about things granted, it's very complicated to explain the credit crisis and the financial breakdown right now. I mean, seasoned politicians have a hard time explaining
that.
But she didn't do herself any favors. She hasn't done herself any favors talking about that.
The one that really jumped out at me, and I was
nuclear.
For some reason people that gets on people's nerves. I don't care about that. I just thought that the response to that question, which is a very serious question, I jokingly said that it should be illegal to ask Sarah Palin that question. But her response to that question was really, really nonsensical. I mean, the question was about when should the U.S. use, under what conditions, which in some ways is a very difficult question to answer for anyone, and a very an extremely difficult question to answer in the abstract hypothetical.
Sure.
But that said, her response had was completely nonsensical, and she ended up pivoting to another question, which is, what should we do about other people getting nuclear weapons? Which is, of course, not at all the question at all. And the way, so that was one place where I felt there was a few places throughout the debate. I think the credit crisis, that question, a few others where I felt that kind of like that sort of like ground falling out from.
Biden, and maybe, I mean, I don't think Biden gets comfort as much because Biden has such a long track record of saying ridiculous things. So it's like that we employ a soft bigotry of low expectations with Joe Biden.
Right.
But Biden, I mean, it's interesting. She made a gaffe because she referred to General McKiernan as General McClellan.
Right.
Which, fine. She got the number of syllables in the first two letters. Right.
I think that's called grading on a curve.
Okay, fine. But then Biden, brought up McKiernan's remarks, apparently unaware that his candidate had endorsed basically an Afghanistan surge.
Right. I thought that was a weird moment as well.
Right. And so that, it sort of put that in the Biden file. And I think in some ways it's because Biden is, I think Biden really likes to get into the details of foreign policy, particularly. I've covered him for many years. And I think that, and I've seen him actually because he thinks out loud, he would be a great blogging head. Right, because he thinks out loud and he can hold two ideas in his head, and so in some sense, now I disagree with Biden's judgment a lot of the times. I don't think it was a good idea to propose dividing Iraq into three provinces along the borders of the Ottoman Empire.
Yes,
as he did, but nonetheless, he's so engaged. Sometimes he just sort of he's still working through stuff. You know what I'm saying? And I think that that's a political liability.
Yeah, right.
Whereas you get the impression with Sarah Palin that, at least from my perspective, on certain things she's got excellent instincts and she kind of knows where she wants to go. And she's filling in the details as she's catching up to speed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So she doesn't have the same kind of problem. Yeah,
right. I think that's an accurate characterization.
Right.
I thought that those instincts, I think, are, I'm not quite sure how I would, what word I would apply to that category
Maverick-y.
Of instincts. Well, no, I wouldn't.
You wouldn't say Mavericky.
I wouldn't say Mavericky at all. I mean, I think that, you know, on foreign policy, I don't think there's, you know, I just feel like she doesn't, you know, I just think that there is no actual, like, I don't know what the raw stuff out of which her foreign policy worldview is currently being shaped is, even. You know, like, it just feels like there's not, and I don't think that's necessarily surprising insofar as governor of a state for a year and a half of a state with 600,000 people. You know, foreign policy, even to me, and I'm you're a reporter that spends almost all your time covering foreign policy and security issues. I spend very little. You know, I myself, as someone who, you know, does this for a living and am a reporter, you know, I myself have not sure how I feel about a tremendous number of foreign policy issues. I'm not sure how to kind of map them onto my matrix of principles. You know, what the Pakistan question, Waziristan, should we, you know, my instincts are tend to be, you know, towards, you know, my instincts are anti-war, anti-imperialist. I'm not, you know, I shy away the use of violence except as a last option. But again, I also recognize the complexity, and I recognize that this is not something that I necessarily have fought on sufficiently to have these very hardened positions, and that's someone who, you know, I get paid full time to think about this stuff more or less. So,
right.
You know, the raw material out of which one would craft a foreign policy in 5 weeks. I mean, it's just like it's sort of a ludicrous task, all of it, really. I guess is my point. Like, you know, what really is she going to say? I mean, she's going to get some talking points on Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the surge being successful in Iraq, and John McCain showing leadership. But there's not going to be a lot more there, just because, you know, it's not. Foreign policy strikes me as an area that less so than domestic policy does not lend itself to kind of the same sort of quick, you know, grooves of worldview.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, she's a mother of, you know, active duty soldier.
Right.
And she had been to a military base.
Right.
So I think that she's generally kind of sympathetic to the view of, like, kind of let our guys win, which is the McCain view and very much the Republican view. And, you know, I think a big difference between Sarah Palin and Joe Biden is that I don't think Joe Biden thinks it's possible to win the war in Iraq, or that there is a set of conditions that he would call victory.
That's right.
Whereas clearly McCain and clearly Sarah Palin do think that.
Right.
And yet there's also, I mean, like, at the same time, Joe Biden has just so many thoughts in his head that I could see him, you know, saying these things. I could see him kind of, like, flitting around various sort of ideas. And, you know, sometimes wonkery is not the font of wisdom. And if anything, you know, one of the key arguments, it strikes me, of the Obama campaign is, like, it's time to sort of change the way we think about foreign policy, you know, politics, the economy, race, and all these other things. Maybe kind of having, you know, a kind of long-established presence in Washington, or, like, you know, a kind of, you know, familiarity with the kind of modes and contours of the current debate is not a boon in this political year. And Sarah Palin is kind of, in some ways, a breath of fresh air.
Well,
she's not as up to speed on the details of these things. And there is a tendency, particularly in the internet, I think, among a lot of Americans, is that, you know, as a democratic nation and a republic, we like to think we're smarter than the president. You know, it's just Americans like this idea. I think, you know, for years, like, everyone's saying how stupid George W. Bush is, and I think part of it is just like, hey, I'm an American, I'm smarter than my president.
Right.
And I think that there's people used to say the same thing about Reagan. It tends to be mainly Republicans. I guess they said it about Truman. There is this, I think that that's just a sort of, that's actually kind of a wonderful thing about our country, is that it's okay after, I guess, John Adams failed to kind of make permanent the alien and sedition laws to say nasty things about our president and think you're smarter than
him.
Right. So, you know, in some ways, she kind of, I don't know, she's maybe kind of hits that nerve a little bit.
Wait, but that, so the argument here is that people feel superior to her, and that makes them like her more?
Let me put it like this. I think it's okay, right, in some respects, right, to be thought of as not as smart as, you know, like some brainiac Harvard professor. The famous line from William F. Buckley is that I'd rather have the first names in the Boston
phone book than the
Harvard faculty.
Right. Of course, he's the guy. Yeah. But and those lines tend to be spoken by people with, you know, incredible amounts of.
Right. Well, it's funny because my last blogging heads, I said we need elites, which we do. We need people who know what they're doing in terms of public policy, so we avoid, you know, financial international calamities.
Right.
But we also, I think that there's also this sort of sense political. I'm just making a political point here, where it's kind of okay to be considered to be not as up to date because that's sort of like, hey, it's like me, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's an interesting point. I'm sort of two minds about this. I mean, one of the things that's really tricky about election year, you know.
Right.
Opining is that, you know, you're forced into making these generalizations about voters, the voters, swing voters, based on, like, you know, what is relative to other places in which you would make, you know, draw conclusions, like very little amount of data. And I think one thing that there sometimes tends to be, like, this weird kind of meta reverse condescension, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but I've seen people say, you know, that, you know, this sort of voters don't really care about substance, or they're more, and I agree with you that the people are not, they do not rank highly. In fact, there was Larry Bartels had an interesting post about this, about how people rank, like, knowledgeable as a trait they want to see in a president, and it's like, you know, it's ranked very low.
Right.
So I think that is true, that people, that's not something that people feel particularly strongly about. At the same time, I do think that, you know, I think that competence, and particularly at moments of sort of anxiety, as we're feeling right now vis-a-vis the financial crisis, I do think that there's a sort of people do look for fluency and competence at a certain level. And I think that, you know, I think we've seen that. I think part of the reason that if you look at the approval ratings for Sarah Palin, they've really dropped off the table. A lot of that has to do with, I think, the Gibson and Couric interviews making people think that she doesn't cross this basic threshold. And I don't know if last night's debate.
Well, I think that she did herself some favors, because when she talks about drilling and energy, I think she comes off fluent. And I think she did fairly well on foreign affairs, all things considered. And I think that when she talks about the predatory lenders, she comes off less fluent.
Yeah. I thought that was actually a fascinating, that was, I think, the most fascinating riff in last night's debate to me was, that's very strange, sort of politically.
A little left-wing populism, right?
I wouldn't even know how to ideologically characterize it, because it was sort of abstract enough that I couldn't quite sink my teeth into it. But that sort of collectivist exhortation to not let us get fooled again, and I wasn't, like, Josic, we're not going to get exploited by these people again. And she used the word exploited, which is this kind of lefty dog whistle, but seem to be putting it in the context of, we're somewhat to blame for letting ourselves get snookered by these bad loans, and we're not going to. Anyway, what was interesting to me about it is that the, you know, I was watching it. I don't know what channel you were watching it on, but I was watching it on CNN with that, like, absurd little.
You know what channel I watched debates on. You know that.
So on CNN, they have this absurd kind of, like, insta-reaction thing where the.
The Frank Luntzemeter. I actually saw the first McCain-Obama debate. It was actually very confusing. Right?
Yeah, it was confusing. But what was interesting, I don't know the empirical and methodological validity of these dials that people were handed. But what was fascinating was, I think that might have been her best, like, that riff, which I had a difficult time parsing, came off incredibly well. Like it rocketed up the dials. So I think that was an example of she does have a certain knack, an instinctual knack for a kind of kind of populist affect that I think.
Well, I'm worried. Where does what party does a fat cat banker vote for now? Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
McCain going after the fat cat bankers.
Yeah.
They usually vote for Republicans, but they don't have a party. So maybe we're going to see a third party schism, sort of like the Wall Street corporatist fat cat banker parties.
I think if you're a fat cat banker.
Yeah, you could vote for Democrats because they give just as much money to the Democrats as they do to the Republicans.
They do. I think if you're a fat cat banker, you get reassuring calls, you know. Like I think you get like chief of staff calling, being like, yeah, I don't, you know, that, you know how we roll, you know. Like, we're not Don't worry, we're not going to be.
You think Chris Cox got that call when McCain called? I mean, McCain called. This is the strange thing about the financial crisis. McCain calls for a 9/11 style, like almost like a truth and reconciliation commission,
right?
And like Obama kind of likes that idea too. And you remember, and Obama at one point says, you know, there'll be time for that later, the blaming later.
Right,
you know
what
I'm saying? Like, trust me. And so you have both candidates promising to offer up the kind of, you know, investment banker CEO types who came up with these ridiculous derivatives. And I have to say, I mean, I'm a free market enthusiast, but clearly I don't think anybody in their right mind right now could say that we do not want to regulate banks to make sure they never come up with made-up products again that nobody knows the real value of.
Right.
Right?
Or if we do, I mean, a huge part of this, right, is that there's two things. There's the complexity of the products is one thing, but then there's the fact the way in which the products are traded. And the way they're traded is what's called OTC or over-the-counter trading, right?
Right.
Which means there's no exchange, okay? So the fact, I mean, maybe you know this, but this is something that I've been sort of digging into recently.
No, I probably don't know it, so I'm actually curious. What is it?
Okay, so like the stock, you know, the way the stock market works is like if I buy shares from you, Eli Lake, I actually don't buy them from you. I actually you sell them to the stock exchange, and the stock exchange sells them to me.
Right.
And the reason you do that is then you can trace everybody's requirements to each other. Okay.
Right.
Well, that doesn't exist for, say, credit credit default swaps. They are, and this is part of the Commodities Future Modernization Act back in 2000. You know, the brainchild of Phil Graham, which Democrats love to point out, and they don't love to point out the fact that who would have signed this bill in the year 2000? A large part of what that bill did was protect these derivatives from being exchange traded, and that is part of what made Lehman's demise so insane, was that as opposed to having exchange in which all reciprocal exchanges are cleared at the end of every day, that doesn't happen with over-the-counter derivatives.
Right.
And so when Lehman goes under, everybody's all of a sudden like finding out what their exposures are, and they're also finding out because of the way these trades happen, not only do they have exposures to Lehman, they have exposures to all sorts of other people because Lehman essentially was, you know, moving things through a chain. Anyway, so
And did you see Sarah Palin in reference to this, and she wasn't getting into the level of detail that you just did, used the refrain "never again"?
Yes.
Which the implication would be like we just had a financial holocaust. Which
I know. I thought "never again" was a little strange.
Anyway, there seems to be this. We're at this sort of moment right now, right? And I was going to sort of bring this up. Actually, I mean, I'm stealing an idea from my friend Michael Moynihan at Reason Magazine because I told him I was going to. And then sort of he said, query Chris Hayes about, you know, right now, because we're in a crisis, right, will we have to sort of turn the phrase from Naomi Klein, disaster socialism,
right,
which is that we're in a disaster right now, so we're going to do all these things at once, which will, you know, sort of like, you know, we're going to go in the sort of 180 other direction. And given the fact that, I guess today, right now, there is the voting and sort of, you know, they're trying to do another bailout bill.
Yeah, 226 to 184, I'm looking over at.
Oh, okay, so you've got that
right
now.
Yeah.
So passed. It passed.
Passed.
Okay,
yes,
and it had a lot of pork in it, right?
Yeah,
But there was this effort, I guess we're not going to see it in this bill, but I mean, will we see in the next administration, if it's Obama, a radical rethink, you think, of how, you know, how we regulate banks and how we, you know, just in general.
That's a good question. I mean, I'd say two things. One, I hope so, but I'm increasingly skeptical that's going to be the case, and it's been somewhat depressing. Two, I think one of the things that's gotten lost, and specifically vis-a-vis Naomi's book, is that one of the points she makes that I think is so that has proved to be quite prescient, particularly in this case, is the fact that disaster capitalism is kind of state capitalism, right? It's all about essentially sort of ersatz free markets, but essentially being, you know, using the power of the state to either create those markets or create incredibly markets with very high barriers to entry, like, for instance, the market for contracts in Iraq. You know, you can't, you know, if you're, you know, the guy from Queens College who wants to, like, start a business and be an entrepreneur, you know, getting Iraq contracts is probably not the place that that's going to happen. It's going to happen.
We don't want the queen. We don't want family mom and pop businesses rebuilding Iraq. You need a huge organization to do that.
Right. Okay. Fine. But the point being that those are markets with highly restricted players, right? And so I think actually in some ways what we've seen with this bailout, it sort of perfectly fits, right? Because that's why we had such an eccentric and interesting coalition voted down the House. I mean, you had a resurgence of the principled old right who saw this as, you know, big government, and they basically said, and some of them were quite frank about it, like, let the thing crash and burn, that's what capitalism is.
Right.
And then you had the left saying, you know, we don't want to essentially, you know, socialize the costs and transfer all this state money into private hands. So I actually think the nature of the crisis and the nature of solutions so far has scrambled political affiliations in an interesting way.
In some ways, it has, yes. Here's the thing, though, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. I look at the Democrats right now, and I see its base as sort of Veblenian, for the Thorstein Veblen, the guy who wrote the book about the loser class.
Uh-huh.
And let me sort of explain what I mean. That the people who vote for Democrats tend to be the sort of masters of the intricacies of our vast economy, and especially a knowledge economy. Mm-hmm. They are, it's not just that they're more educated, it's that Democrats tend to be in industries where expertise matters, and they are the engineers, they're the Silicon Valley people, you know what I'm saying? They're trial lawyers. People who have this sort of specialized knowledge.
So are you talking about the voter class or the donor class? I think that's true of the donor class. I don't think it's true of the voter class.
Okay, that's an interesting idea.
There's 1.2 million people in the Bronx, pretty much all of whom vote Democratic, you know, and they're...
Oh, I see what you're saying. And they vote for Democrats because the Democrats are looking out for working...
That's right. I think it's just... I think you're absolutely right if you want to talk about the donor class. You know what I mean? Like, who's funding the Democratic Party?
Well, what are the Democrats... The Democrats, I mean, like, I'll give you an example of this. Like, you know, the whole idea of the war on science, right? I mean, that was appealing to the technocrats
of
America.
That's right, yes. No, that's true. That's true.
Because even if you didn't understand, as I certainly don't understand, the intricacies of, like, sort of, like, you know, DNA, you know, stem cell research, you know, whatever you are, if you have a certain specialty in the field, you sort of appreciate, well, there are people who know what they're talking about and people know what they're doing, and then there's everybody else. And, you know, to a certain extent, our economy and our society functions because we have this... You know, we've had a geometric expansion of knowledge last 100 years, and you need people to sort of be the masters of very small sort of cul-de-sacs within this huge empire, vast universe of this knowledge. And the Democrats, I think, kind of appeal at least a lot in their, or at least maybe more so with Kerry, to that group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who seem to know about preventing catastrophic recessions and so forth.
Right, that's right.
The economists all said, well, the government needs to do something. There was not a consensus on what the government needed to do.
Right.
But the government, you know, you have to have some massive bailout of some kind.
That's right, yes.
And that's why I thought this realignment was very interesting, because you did have the left of the party in the House say, no, I mean, there needs to be some accountability, and they didn't like the idea of exactly rewarding yet again, as they saw, predatory capitalists, and I thought you saw the same thing on the right. But they were in some ways a kind of coalition against the sort of center and the sort of expert class.
That's right.
And you may not want to believe Bernanke, you may not want to believe Paulson. In fact, I remember reading William Grinder in your magazine, who wrote a whole piece about how they had not earned anyone's trust. And Grinder's been against the Fed for some time.
Right.
But at the same time, you had a number of economists, you know, from both parties sort of saying, well, they're going to have to do something, you know, or else it's going to be really, really bad. And you want to sort of send. So that to me, that's sort of the question of expertise.
I actually think that one of the most fascinating developments the last few weeks, and this sort of nicely kind of segues out of the Palin discussion, and is the status. Let's say first, I want to make a distinction. I think there's a distinction between elites and experts.
True.
And I think that. So, but that gets very murky. So that might be a little more convenient.
But experts tend to be elites.
Yeah, that's right.
Not all elites are experts, but all experts usually are.
Although I think there's sort of a class of bureaucratic experts who aren't really either, you know, who aren't elites. The people in the bowels of the Fed, for instance. But what's been fascinating to me, and what was so kind of radically decentering about last week, was the fact that I really think that, like, the entirety of the establishment has now been discredited. Like, I mean...
Oh, you mean, like... Right.
I mean, like... this goes to your point. We live in an incredibly complicated world, a world that makes claims on our cognitive capacity that are far beyond what we could ever hope to pay.
Right.
And therefore, we outsource a tremendous amount of thinking about things. Even those of us like yourself and I who are paid, who are for a living, follow things and try to synthesize things and learn things. Even us who spend every waking hour doing this, you outsource a tremendous amount of your thinking about these things and your judgments to people that you deem kind of worthy intermediaries. And everyone does this.
Right.
And I think one of the unifying stories of the last 8 years is just the failure of every one of those intermediating institutions to get things right. And last week I felt that very strongly insofar as, it was this kind of moment where we're all like, wow, Wall Street was doing this thing and we presumed, perhaps naively, that they knew what they were doing when they made these derivatives and the Fed knew what it was doing and, Fannie and Freddie and all these people knew what they were doing, and it turned out no one knew what they were doing. It turned out everyone was wrong. Everybody collectively got on board the housing bubble, and there's something pretty. I was at an event the other night where I compared it to the moment in adult life when you realize that your parents are not these kind of infallible demigods who go about parenting you because they have this prophetic sense of the future, but actually just flawed human beings in conditions of epistemic. Right. Uncertainty, trying to make the best out of a series of bad, difficult situations, and that's the kind of invalidation of the elites or the experts, and I'm not quite sure which. I'm sort of murky on my thinking on this, but I do think that's been, in some ways, the story of both the last week and the last 8 years, in a lot of ways.
Interesting, because do you know Michael Crowley from the New Republic?
Yeah. Uh huh.
Okay. Anyway, I like Michael Crowley a lot. He wrote this great piece about Michael Crichton. The writer is Bush's favorite writer,
right?
And it was sort of all about how Bush.
Michael, the coda to that is that Michael Crichton then went after Michael Crowley.
Yeah, I know, that was so ridiculous. it's funny because I actually kind of like Michael Crichton. I mean, I admit I like Airframe and I like Jurassic Park, but
right.
Every Crichton novel is about an expert who thinks he knows everything.
Right, that's
right.
And
turns out to be disastrously wrong.
Right, that's right.
And this is there is a strain, I think, that Republicans picked up, that they like that sort of idea too.
Yeah, right.
And in some ways, the whole blogosphere is predicated in some ways on,
just
a guy in his basement who was reading public source documents and realized that this other guy on CNN was full of shit. So,
yes.
And so there is this clamoring of there's also this anti-expert thing. But in a weird way, the Democrats are in a strange position because the whole, just to kind of pull one case out.
Yeah.
The case against John Bolton
for being
the ambassador to the UN was started as being John Bolton is a dangerous warmonger and we need somebody who's more diplomatic at the UN.
Right.
Which was kind of an argument against him on principle.
Right.
But then it turned into John Bolton doesn't listen to the people who know about the world.
And here's
a parade of these bureaucratic State Department expert types who've testified in private against him.
That's right.
And that the argument was and Barbara Boxer was sort of making these arguments comparing him saying his behavior was sexual harassment, but worse, and all these things. He was harassing the experts was the argument against him, and it ultimately kind of carried the day.
Right.
And the argument, I might add, against neoconservatives was they didn't – a lot of this has been proven to be off the mark. But the so there was this sort of Democratic – and Kerry very much just sort of promising. You see this also with Barack Obama surrounding himself with 300 foreign policy experts and these retired generals who come out for him and stuff, that there is this tendency among the Democrats to want to kind of appeal back to the center, that Bush was radically to the right, disregarded what all these experts said. And then, as you just said, everybody's kind of consensus on the economy just collapsed pretty much.
Right. Yes.
So all these people who knew what they were talking about clearly didn't.
Right.
And so are we going to see the Democrats turn into – what the Republicans were in the late 90s and the early aughts.
Yeah, I think that's this is a really interesting – I think there's a sort of schizophrenia. I think there's a one way to kind of draw a line down the center-left coalition is this kind of establishment, anti-establishment.
Right, and keep in mind, what was the event that sort of led for a brief period for the neocons to be somewhat in vogue? It was 9/11, right?
Right, that's right.
And 9/11 in some ways was seen as the wages of the bipartisan –
interesting. That's very interesting.
Foreign policy. And then we have –
The experts didn't see it coming, and the only people who were, you know, ringing the bell. I mean, I don't think this is the correct narrative for a bunch of reasons, but the political reason for their sort of rise afterwards, you're saying, is the fact that they were seen as a sort of refutation of an establishment that had gotten it wrong.
Exactly,
which is
why when I read, I mean. I think the initial sort of argument about the neoconservatives is way off. We don't have to talk about this, but I mean, you could go into the Rockefeller reports and so forth and actually find there were quite a few people who thought that Saddam Hussein was amassing weapons of mass destruction and had significant ties to terrorism that weren't neocons. In fact, they were their bureaucratic enemies.
Right.
But that said, let's just sort of table that for a second. That said, that the neocons were in many ways the sort of smart guys who were against the establishment consensus.
Right. Right.
And now, who are going to be the new financial neocons
in
that analogy in light of the collapsed consensus
And my huge hope, right, of course, my huge hope is that it's essentially the kind of left populist social democrats, of which I count myself proudly a member. But what's been dispiriting me up this week, I mean, one of the most depressing moments of this campaign to me was seeing the New York Times photo. You know, it was Barack Obama consulting with a sort of cabinet of advisors around the financial crisis, and who's sitting there now? Understandably, these things are scripted to kind of send out soothing messages to Wall Street. But it's Paul Volcker, and then it's Bob Rubin to his left, Bob Rubin. And I'm thinking, you know, what the hell? Like, I mean, and this is actually something that this is a dawning realization for my year in Washington, and I'd be curious what you think of this, Eli. Something I've noticed is that you cannot fail out of the establishment. Like, once you get in, nothing will get you out ever. Like, you know. You know, here we are, however many years later, in a presidential debate, and we have the two candidates debating over whether Henry Kissinger endorses them or not. You know, I mean, it's absurd. And then we have then there's Bob Rubin who you know pushed for the revocation of Glass-Steagall, was working on Wall Street for all the years in which all of these terribly toxic assets were being traded, and he's there at the left hand of Barack Obama, and it's this real dispiriting feeling that once you cross a threshold into this kind of, you know, these sort of centers of the power elite, and this is kind of a bipartisan phenomenon, you know, there's no way to fail out. You know, you can never be discredited, no matter how badly you screw things up. You know, you're just, it's like the eternal recurrence of these same...
Bob Rubin's policies is, you know, I mean, you know, the center-right consensus on the economy, which has been a long time in the making even before Clinton,
led to
quite a bit of prosperity and quite a bit of economic growth. And then, and the question is, was this credit crisis that we're in right now a function of a fundamental mistake about how we understood the role of markets and the role of government in regards to those markets? Was it
yes.
So? Will it require, as I sort of said before, disaster socialism,
right.
which is one view,
right.
or was it just simply like, wow, it would have been really good if in 2003 someone had passed a law that said derivatives of this nature
and these kinds
of financial products are, you know,
that's right.
not kosher.
That's going to be, I mean, those are going to be the battling critiques is the sort of the critique at the margins and the critique at the center. I mean, it's, and not the political center, but the heart.
I would bet on the fat cat bankers in the establishment.
Right. No, I agree.
I think they're going to prevail.
The same way, which is why I found the whole thing dispiriting. I mean, you know, because I actually think the time is ripe for a really top to bottom reconsideration of an entire sort of operating consensus that I think strongly, and I think.
But what would that look like, Chris Hayes?
What does what look like?
Well, what does the top to bottom reordering look like?
I think a few things. One is a recognition that broad middle class prosperity, broadly shared prosperity, is both, you know, better in a moral sense, which is an argument I can make, but, you know, might not persuade people, but also far more stable. I think that's one of the things that we've seen about coming out of this. And it's not an argument a lot of people are making, but part of the problem is that we just had too much capital in global financial markets. And a lot of the reason we've had too much capital is because we've had too much concentrations of capital, and the distribution, the relative distribution between labor and capital has become so skewed, and you have too many dollars chasing too few good investments.
What would you do in response? Would you socialize the means of production?
Well, no. Although
not entirely.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I almost jokingly proposed when people, budget hawks, were talking the other night at this event about how much money we're the government's losing. I almost proposed that we nationalize the oil companies so we can get some revenue. But
pull a little Mossadegh.
What's that?
Pull a little Mossadegh.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. No,
right.
I think a strong essentially re-enlivening of a Keynesian approach, both in terms of the relative balance of fiscal and monetary policy, is a huge, huge story in all this. I think that what's been proven time and time again is that when you have, you know, relatively tight fiscal policy and loose monetary policy, you get asset bubbles. And, you know, that's certainly been the story, and that's kind of one of the underlying stories of this whole fiasco. There are a million different components in terms of re-regulating financial markets in such a way in which you push power away from concentrated centers. There's ways to institutionally and structurally alter the balance of power between labor and capital such that, you know, because really what we have right now is a distributional problem. I mean, we have a problem of who is capturing gains, and that fundamental problem has been created by a lot of things, some of which are nefarious and some of which are not nefarious, and there are policy mechanisms that we can employ that will, you know, change that distribution. And I think that one of the things this has shown, and it's not an argument I hear a lot, is that really uneven distributions in capitalist economies tend to be less stable. And that's something that has some trans... some sort of historical validity
to
it.
Who would you propose to sort of redistribute the wealth?
Well, one of the things...
Popular committees?
The government is one. I mean, that's a role it already plays. I mean, it was sort of an interesting question when
you would want to raise the marginal tax rate to, like, where it was in, like, 1974?
Yeah, yes, we should raise marginal tax rates quite a bit. I think we should redistribute income. I'm an unapologetic redistributionist. I don't, walk away from the word. I thought last night in the debate was interesting when Gwen Ifill asked that question, and Biden sort of interestingly didn't really back down on it. And I think so that part of the sort of Democratic agenda seems like it's fairly sort of mainstream center-left position at this point.
Well, I mean, I think the Democratic Party, though, especially under Clinton, I mean, he ended welfare as we know it.
Right, yeah.
They talk about cutting taxes on the middle class. They rarely talk about raising taxes on wealthy people.
Yeah.
What you're proposing is, you know, kind of back to the future. I don't know, or future. I mean, there may be kind of very new ways of thinking about things.
Yes.
But it seems like you've couched it in dare I say, familiar terms.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair thing to say. I mean, I think there's two ways this can go. One is that, you know, there is a fetish for new ideas, you know, and there's the classic New Republic piece, was it Chait's piece about the case against new ideas. But,
right.
You know, I mean, in a lot of ways, if you look at the new ideas of the neoliberal era, they weren't very new at all.
They were confirming that. I always say that Bill Clinton did more than even Ronald Reagan and Barry Goldwater to kind of end the argument in favor of the kind of conservative critique of mid-20th century American, you know, big government liberalism.
That's right. And but the point being that those ideas were, you know, he was called a new Democrat, but the ideas themselves about, you know, deregulation.
The TOPS program was actually in Goldwater's 64 platform.
Right, exactly.
Right.
But you could go way, way back further. I mean, you could go back to the 1920s, you can go back to the 1890s. I mean, there's, you know, if you look back, actually, one of the fascinating things is to go back and read the literature on relief to the poor in the 1890s. And the critiques of it, and it reads exactly like everything the Heritage Foundation and American Enterprise Institute were putting out in their critiques of welfare. Now, I think, you know, the substance of those critiques aside, it wasn't a new idea, right?
We're like 100 and almost 20 years later from the 1890s.
Right.
we are far more prosperous. The conditions of poor people are not nearly as awful. I mean, we've both read, I'm sure, Jacob Riis's book about poor people in the beginning of the 20th century in the tenements.
Oh, no, of course we're far more prosperous. Yeah,
right.
No question.
I'm just saying, maybe that has to do with the engines of the free market.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, capitalism, you know, in terms of creating wealth, no one's come up with a better system than capitalism. I mean, I'm not arguing. The question is, I mean, there's...
But maybe this crisis says... You know what I mean? The financial markets will, and this is not the first. I mean, we're never probably going to get rid of bubbles, right? But when you have a crisis like this, where you threaten the entire banking system of the world because of this kind of thing, maybe there needs to be, and that's why I start off kind of conceding as the guy coming from the right.
Right.
It is not the slippery slope to socialism. Had someone intelligently said 10 years ago, wait a second, these products are ridiculous.
Right, yeah,
they are
based on
ensuring, you know, fantasies and phantasms. You know.
That's right. No, and one of the things is actually very fascinating, rhetorically and politically, getting away from the substance for a second, because, God, you know, blogging heads, people, they want to hear some politics.
No, they like it.
No, they like
the nitty-gritty. And we haven't even talked about foreign policy yet. This is a good discussion.
One of the things about the politics, it's fascinating to me, is that the first time in my adult life, you have a Democrat attacking a Republican for being for deregulation. I mean, this has not happened in 30 years. I mean, no Democrat has ever gotten to score political points on his or her Republican opponent by saying, that guy was always for deregulation. That's been like the safest bet in American politics for years, to say you were the deregulator, and all of a sudden that's been flipped on its head. So that suggests to me there are these places around the margins where at least the politics of this are changing a lot. I've just been struck this week by the difference between how much the politics could potentially be changing and how much they seem to actually be changing in the moment vis-a-vis what sort of Democrats are proposing.
Interesting. Well, here's what I want to... Let's get to Obama for a second, because you wrote a piece which I remember reading, and I thought to myself that Chris Hayes is onto something, right? And it was tracing Obama's political career.
Yeah.
And you were speaking, I think, favorably of the fact that Obama comes from community organizing background in Acorn.
That's right.
But when he goes to the Senate, like, he was not the Paul Wellstone that people...
Yes, that's right.
...had hoped.
Yeah.
And he seemed to be incredibly pragmatic. And you know, I have to agree with you. I don't know that Obama necessarily believes in anything. And I have been under the view, and I've said this before on Blogging Hands, I've written this, that I think Obama is going to, particularly for the anti-war left, just be a disaster for them.
Yeah.
I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on this, but it's actually, you know, it was really relevant in the context of what you're talking about now, regulating financial markets. Because if he wins, which is looking more and more likely, at least according to the tracking polls, what if anything? I mean, think about it like this, right? There's $700 billion, or up to $700 billion, we should say, that the, you know, further debt that the U.S. taxpayers taken on. It's going to be very hard to, I think, then come to Congress, even a Democratic Congress, and try to socialize medicine entirely. That said, by the way, it cuts both ways. I also don't think that any Republican candidate is going to get anywhere by proposing that we put Social Security in the stock market after what just happened. Also, I think Republicans are probably going to have to think long and hard about whether or not the Bush tax cuts are going to be permanent, because there's a huge crisis right now, and we're talking about an enormous amount of money. So the bailouts take a lot of the agenda from both parties off the table, right? And I think that the fact that in the last 2 years, or particularly the last year, the war in Iraq has gotten a lot better, and the official position as I take it right now is that Barack Obama wants to negotiate the presence of American troops with the Iraqi government, which I think will end up meaning something of a long-term presence. And the left calls them permanent bases, but I think there will be like these, you know, 50-year leases or 99-year leases on a lot of bases in Iraq. So... I think in an earlier Blogging Heads, you even said, if Barack Obama doesn't end the war in Iraq, he's going to have a revolt in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
I actually think he's not going to end the war in Iraq, and I don't think it's going to result. I don't think he's going to have a problem with the Democrats. I kind of want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, you raised some good points. I mean, I have a lot of friends on the left who I think would broadly agree with you. I mean, I think that there's a real worry about... what Brock's core principles are. And I have gone now through several boom bust cycles. more than probably anyone else.
Your own personal Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, exactly. It's been a wild ride. I mean, partly that's because I first came upon Obama's candidacy in the fall of 2003 when a friend was the third staff member hired on the Senate campaign. And, I've gone through a number of sort of periods of feeling like this is truly a kind of transformational figure. The best sort of shot at a kind of liberal Reagan, et cetera. And then through other periods of feeling like, what really are, at the end of the day, are this guy's core principles, and when does pragmatism become, essentially fecklessness? And I can't say that I'm feeling, I think I'm sort of in a trough right now. I think partly because of what I felt was, watching the kind of the old guard of neoliberal democratic economic policies kind of swirl around him, and I think, their vision being carried through this, right, this last few weeks. I honestly feel like it is a cop-out, but I don't know. I do think that you're right in the sense of, in terms of when I said that about the Iraq war, I do think that the reduction in violence and the insane increase in economic anxiety has reduced its salience such that...
Right now I think that the average net left activist is probably going to be looking for... I think there's going to be new battles, by the way, for the left. I mean, it's not to say that they're going to stop organizing. I don't think that's going to happen. But.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think that my statement then in the political context, I think I would hold to, but I think the political challenge is shift. I still think he needs to end the war deeply with, I strongly feel that. But I think if
there was no fighting, but there were 60,000, 50,000 American troops in Iraq, that U.S. Air Force was effectively Maliki's Air Force, which is probably what's going to happen.
Right.
And that right now the unwritten story is that, they're probably going to decommission what was effectively a kind of proxy intelligence special operations force.
Right, yes.
That was a Sunni intelligence force. So that's probably going to probably no longer exist as a result of whatever they end up signing before the end of the Bush administration. And then there would be the status of forces agreement. So there would be not only an elected government, but an elected government preparing for more elections. We just saw that finally they agreed on the provincial elections for early next year. They will probably have national elections to follow, and they would say, effectively, we want some overwatch troops here. We don't want them patrolling. I mean, that strikes me. I mean, like, really, is that at that point an occupation? Is that at that point imperialism? I mean, would you say not good enough? We can't agree to that.
God. Yeah, I mean, my instincts are no, but my instincts are we shouldn't agree to it, or that we shouldn't have any, we should have zero residual troops there. But I do think that from the political context, a beginning of a sharp reduction in troops towards from wherever we are now. What are we at? 120, 130. From there to 60 will create the kind of necessary political capital that that he needs, and particularly a lot of it's going to depend on what actually goes on in Iraq in that period. But I think that I guess my point is that if that's the end point you're envisioning, I think that a beginning to the reduction in force levels there, provides a kind of like basic political cover for the Obama administration.
Yeah, right? The other thing I would say is this, is that it's going to be difficult. If there's no terrorist mega attacks between now and if Obama wins his inauguration, there's a political impetus not to change all that much on the massive increase in the national security, homeland security bureaucracy created under Bush. And this may surprise viewers, but I am very concerned about the proliferation of secrecy and the proliferation of a secret, kind of the secret end of the government doing all these things that there isn't much kind of reporting on. I think you'd probably differ on the prudence at times of using subcontracting lethal force against folks. And then we see Barack Obama called for more of a robust policy in the areas of Pakistan where al-Qaeda resides. His main critique of the Iraq war was not, I don't like the Iraq war because we're exploiting Iraqis and we're we're evil, bad people, which is what you might hear on the left, but rather it's taking our eye off the ball of Al-Qaeda, which is in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So he's committed to this kind of troop surge in Afghanistan, as well as, I think, this policy that Bush approved in July of sending forces into raids, essentially, into the,
into the
territory of Pakistan. Traditionally, the left would appear kind of to be against that, and if
we
they
are.
End up...
We are.
What?
We are.
Right, okay, fine, right, right. And then let's say, you know, Petraeus prevails and finds amenable... this is a big if, by the way, but he finds the equivalent of an Anbar awakening in the Peshawar Valley. That's pretty close to what the Contras were, at least in terms of a war policy. So all these things that Obama has sort of campaigned on, and it gives at least an indication if he's being if he's not being disingenuous, that he would do, all of that seems to a degree, could be like a new area where, you know, you would see the left have a lot of problems with Obama.
Yeah, I think he will have there's no question to me that Obama will have problems to his left flank. I mean, the question is, what are the issues going to be, you know, and a lot of it has to do with, so much has to do with events, and so much has to do with pragmatic calculations he makes in the face of pressure, you know. I mean, I think everyone, I don't think anyone on the left has any illusions about that, and I think that, you know, the key is going to be, it's the real test is going to be how robust these kind of institutions the left has built up. And, on the domestic policy front, I think the big battle is going to be exactly what you just said, which is I can already see this very hardening consensus that the $700 billion means that social investment is out the window. And I think that as a matter of policy, as a matter of countercyclical, as a matter of economics, it's just not, A, the case, and B, is, you know, it is going to be, that's going to be a big battle. I mean, you know, you're already, you saw it with Jim Lehrer, you saw it with Gwen Ifill, this is becoming conventional wisdom.
Right.
We're spending $700 billion, you know, no health care, no social investment, no infrastructure, no green, you know.
Right.
And, you know, if he doesn't win those victories, and if us on the left who are, don't push him to win those victories,
right.
You know, I'm not sure what the future holds. I really feel like everything's sort of positioned on a knife's edge, both foreign and
I think that's right. Now, I do think that you will find a number of people who, I think the left has clearly been strengthened. It's obvious that they've become a more potent political force under the Bush years than they were under the Clinton years. And I think that you're going to see, if I could name check a few people that I predict, and obviously this is perilous, right? Because like they can go on their blogs. But I think like Joshua Michael Marshall, a Talking Points memo, will pretty much become, will endorse, I've known Josh for a long time. I think he will end up being, you know, in Obama's corner on a lot of things.
Yeah.
Because he was, you know, he was a Clinton partisan, you know,
so he will
accept a lot of the compromises that come with to govern. And I wouldn't be surprised if you saw, not necessarily your magazine, but the American Prospect, which, you know, has Rubin and Kuttner, I guess the good Rubin from your perspective, Or, no, I'm sorry, not Rubin, not
the
Rubin,
good Bob.
Kuttner, Reich,
the good Bob.
Bob Reich. I think you're going to see, like, these sort of, you know, these places where you have a lot of the kind of anti-Bush sentiment, where there's been a real kind of cross-fertilization with the left, I think they're going to become very much, you know, defending Obama. And I think you're going to see, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with will Daily Kos turn on Obama? I don't know. You know, they seem to be very much interested in having Democrats win and not as much interested in a kind of coherent ideological critique.
Although one of the things that's very interesting is that you're already seeing this play out right now.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
You're seeing it on the left play out. And part of the reason is when Obama's up, as he is now, a lot of these things flower. When he's down, there's sort of a kind of like, you know...
Don't attack him, right?
Yeah, but when he's up, I mean, you know, on the bailout, like there's a lot of, you know, he's getting criticized a lot. And I actually think that the one of the things that I say to people all the time, and I was having a conversation... The worst thing about the way that the American right conducted itself under the Bush administration, both in terms of, you know, Fox News and a lot of conservative intellectuals and House Republicans, was a sacrifice of principle to sort of subsumed under, you know, anything that Bush does is right. And, you know, you're seeing this break up. And
less so in the last 2 years, I think.
Exactly. No. Much less so in the last 2 years. And I think largely that's a matter of the politics. Right. But I actually find the world of conservative writing and thought much far more interesting now, you know. And I think that, you know, I think that's the big danger for us on the left is, like, you know, there are points of political expediency in which, you know, there is a power struggle, and you want to, you know, there's certain things that tactically you want to see done, mm-hmm. but there's a certain fidelity to one's principles where you cannot just become essentially this mouthpiece for an administration. And
here's the thing, though, like, and I even say this, like, it's really significant that an African American is going to be maybe the president. Wow, it's like the man on the moon. You know,
it's crazily significant. In fact, something I say all the time, and this is sort of comes out of my reporting, you know, white America has no idea how significant this is to Black America. Zero. I mean, what it means, I think, to most African Americans is something that's very hard to kind of get across, contemplate, understand. And part of that's because, yeah, it's just because of the nature of sort of the racial divide in America. But also part of it is that it's just simply that it's something that's very rooted in a kind of subjective, I think, experience and a cultural experience that's a difficult one to communicate and not one that the Obama campaign is going to spend a lot of time on. But yes, the significance is remarkable. I mean, there's no question.
Let me think out loud. And
And we should wrap it up, but we're
two white guys, so talking about race could be perilous. But it strikes me that there were kind of two arguments in the civil rights / post-civil rights era, right? I mean, everybody, there's a consensus now, left and right, that the Voting Rights Act was a good idea, even though at the time Goldwater opposed it for federalist reasons. But, you know, Buckley eventually comes around to that. So obviously there was a recognition that there was a racial caste system for a lot of this country's history after slavery.
Right.
And that was legally ameliorated in many ways, right? Mm-hmm. And then a new debate breaks out, right? And the debate, as I see it, kind of goes something like this. Do you want to focus on the equality of results, which is to say that instances of unemployment, instances mm-hmm. of malnutrition, quality of education are disproportionately affecting African-American communities,
right,
which is the traditional liberal position? Right. Or do you take what became in many ways a kind of conservative position, which is that, you know, we will solve this problem when you have Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice and Black CEOs, and that, you know, there's no barrier to achieving in a stratified economic system, which is that there's going to be poor people and there's going to be rich people. But as long as that race is no longer a barrier to the elite corporate boardrooms and the Senate and the Supreme Court and now the presidency, then at that point. So what happens to that debate, in my opinion, is very interesting because Barack Obama is going to be the first African-American president. That's the highest prestigious position there is, right?
And
in some ways, it ends the conversation. Like, no longer is there a, you know, maybe there's no longer such a barrier.
No.
Well, all right, maybe it doesn't. I'm saying on that one point, which was sort of always a conservative, you know, it's a point. But then what happens to the other argument that the left has brought up now for quite some time since the Kerner Commission about the effects of, you know, the sort of disparity of results, the equality of results as opposed to equality of opportunity?
Well, I don't. I see them as pretty distinct, actually. I mean, I think that, you know, I think that India obviously had a, you know, a woman prime minister, and I don't think anyone would call India a feminist paradise. I think that, you know, there's a long history of sort of these kind of there's a long history in which the achievements of a single individual who comes from a group that is socially marginalized can have a distinct, you know, be distinct from the broader socioeconomic status of said group. So I think it'll do interesting things. I think, which is not to say I don't think it'll do interesting things to our natural conversation about race, and I think that what you're highlighting is actually an argument I've already heard sort of preemptively from conservatives. In fact, I heard a conservative say to me, it was a friend's mother who said, the one silver lining for me about Barack Obama being president, and she does not want Barack Obama to be president, is that, you know, Black people can never talk about racism again.
I didn't mean it like that. I mean, listen, racism exists.
Right.
And
no, but I wasn't accusing you of making that argument. But I think that there's a certain, no, I know you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But there is, So, yeah, I think that, you know, it's going to be one of the things that, and maybe I'll end on this note in terms of this racial discussion, you know, one of the things that, again, in these boom busts of Barack Obama's candidacy,
mm-hmm.
I've also had these boom busts, you know, there's these periods where I say, well, maybe we're just going to elect a black president and no one will notice, you know? And then something happens where it's like, oh, no. We're gonna have to confront this sucker head on, you know. Like, this is not gonna like just sneak by, you know. We're gonna actually, and so that boom, that waxing and waning that's happened throughout the campaign, I think, you know, it's not gonna stop once he's elected. You know,
let me end on this question then. So these are just questions, okay? But in the African American community, there's far more. I mean, you know. See, this is awkward because I'm obviously right. Melanin deficient. So,
right.
but there is a tendency. I listen to a lot of hip hop music, and I don't know. There's a tendency sometimes to sort of just have no enfranchisement or buy-in to the federal government, particularly under George W. Bush. But you know, a lot of African Americans just sort of believe the worst about the nature of things in sort of Washington at the highest levels. If Barack Obama is president, will there be, in some ways, more of a buy-in by virtue of that?
Yes.
I don't think, by the way, I'm making an outrageous point. I mean,
No. I actually think, you know, I think, let's stipulate it up front, generalizations of these nature are tremendously sticky.
Obviously. Generalizations are really bad. Right?
There's a lot of white people with similar feelings. I think as a general statement of a certain strain within African-American social cultural life, a deep skepticism of the motives of government at all levels, I would actually say,
right.
Not just federal government, is strong. And I think you're right. And I think, yes, I also think that it will have a direct effect on that.
Right.
I think both. I would agree with both those statements. In fact, that might be one of the most
yippee. Good. Right.
Yeah, I think that would be. I think that is almost certainly likely to happen.
Okay. Well, that's all right.
So let's end there.
Let's end there. Thanks a lot, Chris Hayes.
Are you from the Bronx? I enjoyed it from the Bronx.
You are from the Bronx. I'm from Philadelphia.
You're from Philly, okay.
Right.
I thought you were a New Yorker for some reason, but maybe.
Well, I said I write for the New York paper.
Yeah.
Or did a New York paper that just closed. So.
All right. Well, good luck in your future travels. I'm sure you'll land. I'm sure a reporter as fine as yourself will land on his feet.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and good dialogue.
Okay.
Okay.